And one, probably 6 or 7 year old, came up to his mom, goes, "I don't feel anything." You know, and he was surprised that he couldn't feel the light, because it does. It feels like it has, or when you look at it, it has such solidity to it.
Yeah.
As it goes through the fog.
The opposite side of that is, I heard another kid say, as he's holding his hand into the beam, "Can this burn my hand?" Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it should be able to. Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. What brings you out of retirement, you say? Which is a little bit rude, I think. I mean to ask that. I wouldn't say that we're retired. Tired, maybe, but not retired. Well, what brings us back to the podcast? Was it the Oscars? Was it a great movie? A good poem? Good book? A shaft of light projected through a smoky room? A funny word like horticulture? Or nevertheless? It was actually, yes, it was one of the above. And here to help me explain which of the above brings us back to the podcast is J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
Good to hear you.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Yes, good to podcast again.
And what brings us to our podcast tonight?
Well, I was thinking that it's kind of funny how it wasn't the great movies we've seen. We've seen a few. Neither of us have seen probably as many movies as we have in the past, but
no,
we
right.
saw Hugo.
Yes,
chatted about
it. I love.
Yeah. Talked about it on the way out of the theater. Didn't podcast about it.
No.
But last night and tonight, we saw A Cone of Light. Got a podcast about it.
Yes. Yes, because how often do you get to talk about A Cone of Light?
Exactly. This is a series of works by a guy named Anthony McCall. And maybe you should explain what these are.
Well, it's Anthony McCall is he was a filmmaker and still is in the late 60s, early 70s, and did sort of known as a structuralist filmmaker. And his most famous work is this 1973 work called Line Describing a Cone. And it's somewhat hard to describe, but it's just a 30-minute film in which it's shown in a completely dark room that's been filled with some sort of smoke or fog or mist of some kind. And it first starts with just sort of a beam of light that kind of cuts through the smoke or the fog and hits a wall on the other side. And then slowly over the course of 30 minutes, it traces a circle. But because it's going through this fog or smoke, it creates a cone. Because, of course, it starts at the projector. It's quite small, and then it opens up to something quite a bit larger on the far wall or the screen. And so if you look at it from the side as it's nearing its end, completing the full circle, it becomes a cone. And so the title is quite apt. It's a line describing a cone.
Yeah, if you were sitting in a theater watching this, you'd see a dot on the screen that gradually draws around to be a circle over the course of half an hour.
Yes.
But of course, you're not sitting in a theater. You're standing in just an empty room with a bunch of other people. And so you're not actually looking at the screen that much or the wall, whatever it's projected on. You're sort of looking into the cone, what becomes a cone.
Yeah.
At first, it's just kind of like a curling wave or something. Or at first, it's a shaft of light, but it becomes kind of a curling wave and eventually a complete cone.
Mm-hmm.
It's very pure and simple, but it's very cool to just sort of stand there and feel like it's a solid thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what some people refer to his works as solid light,
yes.
Which is a good way to describe it because it really almost feels graspable.
It does. Yeah, we saw two different versions of it, and I'm sure we'll talk about this at length in a moment, but last night's was the original 1973 version, which is done on film, 16 millimeter film. And then tonight we saw a 2010 version, which is on digital video. But when we saw it last night, there were quite a few kids. And the kids sort of, I think even more instinctually than the adults, knew that it was to be played with, at least at some level. And one, probably 6 or 7 year old, came up to his mom, goes, "I don't feel anything." You know, and he was surprised that he couldn't feel the light because it does. It feels like it has, or when you look at it, it has such solidity to it.
Yeah.
As it goes through the fog.
The opposite side of that is I heard another kid say, as he's holding his hand into the beam, "Can this burn my hand?"
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like it should be able to.
So what was your experience of it?
Well, I actually saw them in a different order than you did, so maybe that will affect how I feel about them. You saw the 1973 version long ago, several years ago, and had told me about it, and so I sort of had this picture in my head, but my first experience with his work was last night. Before we saw these two, there was another one called You and I Horizontal, which is from a few years ago. It's digital, and it isn't just a simple circle that's being drawn. It's a much more complex shape. It's kind of... it changes over time, but it's like maybe an S sometimes, or an S with a line cutting across. And it's changing very gradually, like morphing as those lines are drawn. But it makes a much more complicated solid, if you think of it as a solid, that you're walking around. The other difference is, as far as I could tell from the way they're showing it anyway, it doesn't have necessarily a definite beginning and end.
Yeah.
It's just sort of running on a continuous loop. And so you come in and you leave. And that seemed to encourage, I felt like, a more... I don't know if that's what did it, but maybe that was one of the things that encouraged a more sort of casual approach that people had to it. You sort of come in, you play with it, and you watch it change. And I found that to be really cool, the way it would make these shapes that were sometimes like monoliths or like a slab of something. Like if this were a sheet of ice that just slid off of a roof, it'd be decapitating me right now because my head is, I'm sticking my head in here. It was so neat. Although when I first walked in, my first reaction was, "Wow, that's kind of neat." I think I'm gonna go. You know, we'll stand around here for a minute while we're waiting for the main thing we came for. But then, you know, 30, 40 minutes later, we're still standing there, like, "Oh, look at this! Yeah. Oh, look what happens if you do this?" I mean, it's kind of amazing how it draws you in.
Yeah, it is. My experience of seeing You and I Horizontal, and then comparing it to line describing a cone is that. Because there's sort of multiple lines going on, it feels much more planar as sort of planes of light, whereas a line describing a cone is very much about a line, and then the way that sort of creates sort of one curve, whereas You and I Horizontal, because it's different lines that are shifting, it's fun to look at how those interact as planes. You know, I was particularly fond of the moment when it sort of becomes kind of an oval, but the oval becomes very thin. And so really there's a top and a bottom, and you can almost stick your hand in between the top and the bottom of the oval. And then as that changes, the dimensions change. And it was just fascinating to watch and to play with it.
Yeah, another one of the differences I felt between that and both versions of the line describing a cone was how it definitely felt structural or sculptural, I should say, maybe. And the cone one, when it's finished, it almost looks like that classical image we all know from having sat in any movie theater. When you turn around and look sort of up at the projection booth, you see that cone of light. Basically, it's shining out. It looks very familiar. And yet, because we just sort of watched it be created, and we're sort of encouraged to stick our heads in it and play around with it and see all these minute details that we'd never noticed or had never really turned around and looked toward the projector instead of the screen, you see all these things that you never really noticed about the way projectors and light work. And it's almost strange to feel that you have watched movies for so long, written about movies for so long, and yet don't understand fundamental things about how it works. Like, to me, one of the cool things was having seen these in two different media. The one in 1973 is on film.
Right.
And there's a film projector back there making the sound as it's going through. But in any film that you're watching that way, you're not just watching the pictures that we're taking. Over time, there is some decay in the film. There is some dust that it picks up.
Yeah.
And you see that as little speckles on the screen. We're all familiar with sort of what that looks like. But when you're standing in it as a cone, those things have a really strange effect. They look like shafts of light shooting past you just in a blink of an eye. It feels like you're in the Millennium Falcon and you know the TIE fighters are blasting at you. And that very thing made me wonder how this works, because it really looks like each of those specks is shooting past me as like a rod of darkness on this light sometimes if it's a white speck. But it can't really be shooting past me. I mean, it is. It's light. It's traveling. But my eye cannot be detecting the speed of light, the speed that it takes to travel 20 feet, 30 feet past me. So why does it feel like it's moving always in that direction, always toward the screen?
Yeah.
And I think it really must be that this is the only, my only explanation for that is that it it also is not a rod. It's also a slice of a cone.
Mm.
It is a cone, actually. Mm. And so it's smaller at the projector end, and it's bigger at the screen end. And so it's an optical illusion that it sort of looks like it's traveling past me.
As it quote-unquote, is getting bigger, kind of?
It isn't, though. It's just flashing. Sure. It's on one frame, and then it's gone, probably, because it's a speck of dust. Yeah. Or it's on maybe two or three frames. But I don't know. So just having to think about the very simple thing of how a movie works on this very almost molecular level, it's not something you get to do very often.
Mm-hmm. We should probably describe a little bit of how you watch this, you know, all of his works. You know, we've mentioned that it takes place in sort of a dark room without any chairs, and you sort of watch it. And typically, particularly with Line describing a cone, you sort of stand on either side of the beam, and you sort of watch it, and you can look back towards the projector, or you can look to the screen. But as time goes on, and as the cone is starting to be drawn, or the circle is starting to be drawn, pretty much everyone will start to move into the cone. And so they are sort of in the middle, looking usually straight back towards the projector. And that's even true with You and I Horizontal, which is a more complex series of lines. And yet still, typically, you can stand off to each side and you can look at it from this almost profile view, or you can stand in the middle and sort of look on it sort of the long way towards the projector. And all the works, I think, encourage you to move. You know, because you want to see what this looks like from different places. You want to look, you know, what does it look like from the side? What does it look like from underneath? You know, there's this real joy in sometimes, you know, sitting on the floor and very low on the floor sometimes and looking up as the light sort of is, you know, sort of hovering over you. Or you can go towards the back where the wall is and sort of see, really you're sort of looking at silhouettes. You're looking at people who are in between you and the projector and the impact that they have on the light or on the, you know, the cone or the shape or whatever it is that you're looking. And so that idea of moving around, I think, is really central to the piece. And you experience, strangely, what is a very simple thing in very complex ways and in a variety of complex ways. And it's fascinating to me to have, you know, because like you say, I think the initial reaction when you see it is, oh, okay, all right, well, okay. And then you sort of assume that you're going to stay for 5 minutes and you're going to go, you know, do something else with your life. And yet it just is so fascinating in how, it, depending on where you stand and depending upon what other people are doing as they stand in the light, the experience that you have of it. And I find that really profound.
Well, yeah, even socially. I mean, what you just said, the way you described it is, what you do is you go in and you stand on both sides, but no one told us to do that.
Right.
All they'd said is, oh, go in here, take two rights, and then you're in the room. And so we go in the room, but you're right, that is what people did. And it's fun to watch what people are doing. Mm. Like, why are you, we're all standing sort of like we don't want to be in the way. And
yes.
It was a big difference. I found the ones that have, the one that felt more like an installation where we just sort of wandered in and then wandered out whenever we wanted, felt really different from the one that had a very definite beginning and end. It lasts 30 minutes and you're going to see the circle be drawn. So we're all standing there anticipating it. No one wants to be in the way.
Right.
Waiting for it to start, and then there it starts. Oh, there's the line. Everyone's quiet and whispering. There's no music or sound effects with any of this. But it's funny that you bring in a lot of your sort of traditional film watching habits with you. Even though it is going to encourage you to get in, at first no one wants to break that ice of being the one to do that.
No. And I was thinking about it. There was a symposium I went to earlier today where they were talking, various academics were talking about McCall's work. And a curator at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, she thought that people weren't going to enter the cone until the cone was actually above them, that somehow there was something about the cone being above us that then initiates people in. And I think there's some truth to that. But tonight I was particularly thinking about that. And I do think that people don't want to get into the cone if they're going to pretty much block all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the cone starts at the bottom. So it starts, you know, it's very low to the ground. And so therefore, there's sort of really no way to stand in the middle without just completely blocking the light from reaching the wall. And I don't think anyone really wants to be the person that gets in the way.
Yeah.
And so you have to wait for it to get up enough that even if you stand in the middle, you're not blocking, you know, a majority of the light.
Yeah.
And so I think on a very sort of simple level, that's what sort of keeps people off to the side.
Yeah.
I think it'd be quite a different experience actually if the cone started at the top, and then worked its way, you know, in the other direction. People might get in the middle maybe a little bit more quickly than they do this way.
That's a good point. Yeah. Or if it weren't slow, if it sort of like drew very quickly and then sort of changed speeds or it was just a rotating arc or something like that, I think it would produce really different results in the people.
Yes, yes. Well, and you and I, horizontal is like that, right? I mean, it's, I mean, we sort of came in the middle, whatever that is in that work. And everyone was already in the middle, you know, and you didn't feel like you were getting in people's way. You felt like that was part of the experience.
Yeah.
So
halfway through both versions of the cone, I had the same feeling that I wished that someone would suddenly pull the plug, throw on the lights, and take a picture from the ceiling, you know, an aerial shot of this, because you'd see people in these funny, you'd see people sort of generally in a cone, like a triangle shape, but then you'd have other people who are holding their hands up or tilting their heads in funny ways, and other people were thinking the same thing, because I heard a woman say something like, if this suddenly went off, I think you'd still see the residue of the cone.
Yeah, it's nice.
And I loved that phrase of the residue of the cone, as if this light has some sort of remnant that it's going to leave behind. It certainly leaves it in the people.
Yeah. That aspect, I think the social aspect of the work is really maybe my favorite part. It means that whenever you see it, if you ever have a chance to see it, your experience will be different. Just by definition, it depends on the people around you and how they interact with it. I don't know if this is just me personally, but I really, my favorite personal spot to be in is sort of towards the back. As long as people
near the screen,
right? Near the screen, right?
Looking sort of toward the projector,
looking back towards the projector. As long as people near the projector are playing with it, as long as they're sort of sticking their hands and sort of, you know, they can make rabbit ears if they want. That's not usually what people do. They sort of let their fingers kind of flit and float. But to watch the way that creates this sort of shadow within the cone, and the way it genuinely transforms the sculpture of the piece is striking and beautiful. And I found myself both last night and tonight sometimes giggling, you know, just like when someone did something particularly interesting, it's like, oh, that's great. But sometimes it takes people a while to start doing that.
Yeah.
You know, people aren't, you know, I think there's almost a reverentialness that sometimes people bring to this where they don't want to affect people in a wrong way. And so therefore they don't want to play with it. And mm-hmm. So it takes people a while to figure out that's kind of part of what you're supposed to do, at least.
I like being in that spot too and seeing somebody who's standing there, you see their silhouette. Mm-hmm. And if the cone is fairly complete at that point and the smoke is sort of wafting through it and it has this sort of, I don't know, tie-dye look almost, a monochromatic kind of texture, it looks like they're going through hyperspace or traveling through the time tunnel or something. I love that too. It's a very cool effect.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing about this is we saw two versions of line drawing a cone, one from 1973 that's on film, one that's from just 2 years ago that's on digital video, and they're really different. I mean, it's exactly the same thing as far as I can tell. It's a dot that draws into a circle, and yet the very fact that the media is so different creates all these very different effects, not just the dust things that I was talking about before or the sort of imperfections that have developed in the film.
But those are profound, though.
They are. I mean, they're like whizzing past you fairly often.
And just you know, the kind of the degradation of film, I think, is part of what makes film in certain ways. I mean, you have a really strong appreciation for that when you're watching the original 73 version.
But yeah.
Anyway,
the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Sound of the projector you hear in the film version, and the other it's silent. I guess you hear the fan running a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the smoke machine, which is a you know, every once in a while, and everyone hears that. Oh, here it comes. It's very neat. But you can also see pixels in the new version, and when you're looking at the screen, you're seeing sort of a circle that is a little bit jaggy on the edges, as any digital picture is. But when you're looking at the cone, you're seeing it as shafts of very, very faint shafts of light.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's strikingly beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like very faint corduroy. I mean, it's just it's this sort of ribness of the video, and it's really it becomes part of the structure. I mean, I think I mentioned to you earlier that it feels both more solid and less solid, the video version does.
Yeah.
But it feels more solid to me in the sense that you can really sort of see the lines.
Yeah, it feels very crisp because its edges are very clearly defined. The blacks are a little bit blacker because in the print that we saw of the film version, the white circle is on a black background, but the black is a little bit faded, and so there's actually a lot of light. It's almost like the cone is within a big brick, a big like rectangular structure, and so that's a part now of the whole
I think you also brought up the importance of sound and the difference between when you watch it on film, you actually hear the projector, whereas when you're watching on DV, it's pretty silent. I mean, the fan will sometimes kick in. But Anthony McCall today talked about how he thought that the film projector was a really important part of the 73 version because it encouraged quiet conversation. In other words, because there was this sort of drum or hum of the projector, people felt free to talk.
Yeah.
Whereas they didn't really feel free to talk at all tonight until well into the piece.
Yeah.
There was for the digital video version, people were quite silent for a long time.
Yeah.
And then once there was sort of the ice was broken, then sometimes people were quite loud tonight.
Yeah.
Which wasn't quite so much the case, the last night's film version.
Yeah. Big guffaws of laughter. I think another thing about the film version is you mentioned that it's both more and less solid, the digital one.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. It's like because you can't see between the pixels, it's just a smoother mass. It's a fuzzier, softer image.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it also has a break. It's not a perfect circle. There's, for some reason, the way it was drawn, it doesn't completely come together at the top.
Right.
It's almost like a piece of paper that has been rolled into a cone and taped, but there's still kind of a seam there. It's not a perfect cone.
Right.
And that is the effect. It's just a little bit off, maybe by design, I don't know, but it's just the way it is. It's a cool sort of not quite perfect circle, which creates this not quite perfect cone.
And that also reminds me of something else. As you get closer and closer to actually the work being complete and the circle being complete, what becomes most interesting to me is the break and looking at the gap. And so you have this absence of light, and the absence of light becomes particularly interesting as you get sort of closer and closer, and that absence of light gets sort of smaller and smaller until finally the circle is completed and there is no absence of light. It's a perfect cone. But that sense of having seams, I think, is sort of fundamental to the work in the sense of, at first you're noticing light, and then at some point you switch and you start noticing absence of light and how that works and what happens with that.
Yeah. It was also very interesting. A lot of people noticed in the digital video version that there is color in the light. I mean, the way the video projector projects this is different from the way the film projector does.
Right.
In the film projector, it's a bulb that's emitting white light, a certain spectrum, but it's just a sort of a smooth white light where the video is combining three colors and you can see those split when you run your hand very quickly through the light. And so people are fanning their hand in the light, and you're seeing red and green and blue in there sort of combined and split, which is very neat, prismatic effect.
What I also noticed tonight, which it caught me by surprise, was it also happened just when, not when people were moving their hand quickly, but if they themselves were, if you were sort of looking back towards the screen, and by this time a lot of people are in the middle of the cone, if they move their bodies, suddenly there'd be bursts of red or bursts of blue or bursts of green on their body where they had moved and the light had struck them differently.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by that. I was like, oh. And so then I'm trying to, it's not the sort of thing you watch. It's the sort of thing that hits you out of the side of your eye. It's like, oh, there it is again.
Yeah.
And, it's like a flash of lightning almost.
I thought there was a sort of a missed opportunity tonight because we're seeing this in Chicago when it's like 20 degrees outside. And outside, we're all like, you know, we're shivering, and you can see everyone's breath. In the room, it's very nice and warm. But I thought if they had thrown open the doors and the windows, it would be really cold in here. And instead of the smoke machine, you would see the effect of people being near the light. You know, I thought that could have been cool.
Oh, that would have been cool.
Because when the smoke is wafting through, I would sometimes wave my hand, and it creates swirls in the smoke, or you can blow. And you're creating, you're sort of changing the texture on the cone, which is really neat. And apparently in the 1973 version, they relied on cigarette smoke.
Yep.
And of course, that's not allowed now. Another one of the social things you can't help thinking about while you're standing there contemplating all these pieces.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. When I was describing this to a friend earlier in the week and telling what I was going to do Friday night, he wasn't exactly dismissive. But when I said, you know, it was done in 1973, he goes, oh, well, that explains everything. And the funny thing about the piece is it feels, it makes sense that it would have been made in the early 70s of a time with its, you know, the social fabric that it was. And yet it still feels really contemporary to watch. I mean, Tom Gunning today had a really nice way of putting it. He goes, when he saw it in the early to mid 70s, he thought it was a stripping away of film. He thought that what McCall was doing was stripping away everything that Hollywood tries to add to film and getting back to sort of a pure cinema. But he says that since then, and particularly when he's seen it in the last 10 years, he finds it actually to be more a revealer of cinema, that when he watches it, he sees so much more about movies than he ever had noticed before, because he's just seeing things that he hadn't thought about and looking at light in ways that he hadn't considered before. And I like that. I had a sort of a similar experience of this sort of revealing of like, wow, I had never noticed that before.
And it's surprise, you know, you really value those moments as a film goer, as a cinephile that can reveal things you didn't know about movies. That seems almost impossible, but it's true. And it also made me think a lot about this shift in media that's happening. You know, Kodak has filed for bankruptcy. Film is just not going to be manufactured anymore. Yeah. Everything's on digital video. And as a film goer, as a movie goer, going to the multiplex to see whatever the latest movie is, it's not a huge difference, I think. There are some aesthetic differences. They're very subtle. For the filmmakers, it's a bigger change.
Yep.
They have smaller cameras. They edit it differently. They distribute it differently. But where it's really most profound is with these sorts of filmmakers who are doing avant-garde work, because their medium, their art form is celluloid, a lot of them. Yeah, when you think of Stan Brakhage or Peter Tchaikovsky or Jennifer Reeves, these are people who are actually working with the medium.
Yeah.
They're in some cases hand-painted films. They are exposing the celluloid to chemicals to create interesting effects, abstract effects. Peter Tchaikovsky is this guy who does these really amazing things with found footage, or actually it's from, he did this very famous one from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
And when you're watching it, it's sort of hard to know how in the world he created this effect, but it's almost like a recreation of that movie in some ways, in a very short form. Like it's 10, 15 minutes long, I think. And there's scenes of, you know, Clint Eastwood and riding on his horse and all this kind of, it's very a funny kind of film, the way it's all edited together. But his process is really amazing. He goes into a dark room. He has a board. He takes a strip of unexposed film and tacks it to the board. And then he takes an equal length strip of something like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and he layers it exactly on top of that. And then he sits there listening to music with a laser pointer, and he draws through The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or whatever the film is he's working from, onto the unexposed to sort of create these hazy after images, or these sort of, he can choose which pieces of the original he wants to expose in his own movie.
Yep.
And so it's, in some ways, it's a drawn or a traced movie. And he does this, you know, he spends a lot of time on this to come up with a 10 or 15 minute movie.
Yeah.
But that's his medium. And when you say, oh, film isn't going to be made anymore, well, this sort of art that won't exist anymore. It's like telling a painter, well, we're not going to make canvas and oil paints anymore. You can use all these other things.
Yeah.
But that's really different.
Yeah.
And saying, I think that whenever I read about the changes that are happening in the news, they never mention this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They mention how the shift is to digital, but they never mention this sort of loss of certain kinds of filmmaking. And many of these artists will and have done lots of video work and will do that and be interesting there too. The older folks maybe just will stockpile 16 millimeter film and hope it will last for as long as they do. But it is kind of sad to think about the passing of an entire sort of art form, really, without much comment. And it's strange that a cone of light will make you think of that. But by seeing it in two different media, it really provokes all kinds of thoughts like that about how profoundly different they are.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And there's almost, and maybe this is just because we're of a certain age where we grew up with film, but we're young enough that we're going to be around hopefully longer to see the age of not film. There's a nostalgia to it. You know, I had a few different moments last night and tonight where there was this feeling of nostalgia. You know, for a time when we won't hear the click, click, click of the projector. I thought that there feels like a loss there. There feels like something is, and again, that's I think it's pure nostalgia, at least in certain ways. But you're exactly right that in other ways, it's a very profound shift.
In some ways, it is pure nostalgia. I mean, nobody likes the fact that film decays. Right. Nobody likes the fact that film can break and you have to splice it back together, and that it is a huge thing that has to be shipped to theaters instead of being sent over a network or something. I mean, these are things that aren't practical.
Right.
But they inspired a lot of creativity to use those aspects of the medium. Mm. And I think that when you take it to extremes, like some of these avant-garde filmmakers have, they really thrived within that medium, and now it's different.
And I think one of the things, and this is maybe related, that I was considering the last couple nights is, you know, when I think of sort of the decay of film, I almost always think of that in a very negative way. You know, it's like you go to see an old movie and you're wondering, okay, is it a new print? If it's not, what sort of print are we getting? You know, is it going to be really ugly? Is it going to be all pink or, you know, lots of scratches or whatever? But watching the print last night, I had a feeling that I sometimes have when I think about John Cage's work, and the appreciation of what you would think is imperfection as part of what you're experiencing. And that sense that the decay of that film is actually part of what the experience is. And I was thinking about that on a number of levels, because I saw the line describing a cone at Toronto International Film Festival in 2004. And so, you know, seeing it 8 years later or so, I was struck by, obviously my experience is different, you know, just because my memory of it is different. And, you know, certain things that really struck me 8 years ago don't quite strike me in the same way anymore. And yet the fact that there is this contingency, in other words, that there's the viewing of it is contextual, and therefore it's never the same. Mm-hmm. That becomes very clear in line describing a cone, because as we mentioned, so much of it depends on the audience, and depending on what kind of audience you really do have a different experience. But even the film itself is different. It's not just that I've changed, the film has changed. But I don't guess that would be quite true in the digital video version. I mean, I would expect that would be the same.
But probably not. But probably not, because things change. I mean, if nothing else, your view of it will change because, you know, video will get better and you'll think, oh man, look how pixelated this is. I don't even see that anymore. Yeah, this is really dated. Something about it will be different, you know, the experience, I'm sure. Mm. Ricky Jay has this interesting book, Photographs of Dice, you know, like dice in, like they use in Vegas.
Okay.
Dice apparently used to be, I don't know if they still are, made of celluloid. Mm. And they decay, just like film does.
Okay.
And he has these amazing photographs of old decaying dice. Mm. And they're really kind of beautiful, I mean, in a weird way. And so, yeah, there can be some beauty in the decay.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about how you think your experience of line describing a cone was different because you saw You and I horizontal. What were some things, and can you imagine how it might have been different if you had seen it in a different order?
Yeah, I think it made me a little irritable during line describing a cone. Well, I mean, I really enjoyed walking straight into You and I horizontal, playing with it, watching all the weird shapes. We were there. It was really 30 or 40 minutes. Yeah. This was unexpected because we really went for the cone, but they were showing this other work beforehand, and I'm so glad we got there in time to see it.
Yeah.
Then we went in for the cone, which has okay, everybody, we're going to start now. We're all in a black room. Everybody's there.
And we should set this up because it's not just that, you know, hey, we're going to start now. There's a 10 to 15 minute break where the artist has to prepare the work, right? And so in other words, there's this sort of bracketing of the experience, you know, like, okay, now the real thing is about to begin, and, yes. and you know, the artist is here.
Yes, and not because he's a pretentious guy or anything, but just simply they have to set up the projector. It's different from the old one, and we need everybody into the lobby, and we're going to go do this, and we're going to... Yeah, but because of the ceremony and the formality of that, we all go in, we all sort of line up along sides of where we think the cone's going to be. A lot of people sat down, mm-hmm. which I think was the thing that I which annoyed me at first, because I felt like, you're doing it wrong, you know? And no one knows given any of us instructions, so it doesn't make any sense for me to think that. But I want to appeal to authority and say, you know, he says you should interact with this or something. But no, it was just different from what we had experienced before, where people were milling around. But now it's a much bigger crowd, because this is what people came to see. And so we are packed in a little closer. A lot of people are sitting in spots where I want to be able to sort of move around. Yeah. And so that's a different aspect. But another thing I noticed shortly after that was that as it started arcing up around and the smoke comes through and it feels very solid, when I'm in the cone, I can't see what's outside the cone. I'm completely in a world of my own. And I was trying to remember that there were people seated right outside it and below it in the dark, so that I wouldn't just start, you know, walking that way and stepping on people. Yeah. But the other thing I noticed is you came up behind me or beside me right about then, and I said, I feel like I can't see through this cone, but I think there are people right here. And as I said that, I realized that I sort of felt like I was just talking to you. But of course, those people I was talking about were just as close to me as you are. But because they're on the other side of the cone, it feels like they somehow can't hear me.
Yeah.
cone of light.
It is a striking sense of space, of somehow this light creates, I mean, not walls. It doesn't feel like a wall, but it feels like a inside and an outside. It feels like an above and a below. It feels like there's something there. The closest thing I can liken it to is Richard Serra's sculptures, he does these massive steel sculptures that are very wave-like or cylindrical. And but both McCall's work and Serra's work reconfigure space for me in ways that I otherwise don't think about. I came home last night and I left the lights off for a second, because there were just all sorts of lights coming into my apartment from surrounding construction sites and the like. And the beauty of these kinds of things, and I think of a lot of not just avant-garde cinema, but just really good art, is it just makes me understand my own world in different ways. That I stop and I look and I go, wow, that's really beautiful. And something that I would have completely ignored and I have ignored, you know, for nights on end. I stopped last night and I just looked I find that to be a very profound experience.
I had that feeling too, that I first, when we were sort of shooed out of You and I Horizontal while they set up a line describing a cone, we're standing out in the lobby. And we're sort of near a table of brochures and things. And I noticed as I leaned over to look at one that my silhouette was there because of the bulbs that are overhead. And I was thinking, hey, look how I'm casting this thing here, and nobody cares. We're all just milling around. People are drinking wine, eating cheese or whatever, and nobody cared about that light. But then also, as I was driving home afterward, you know, the shafts of light from my headlights were just, everything is so, you do sort of see everything in a different way.
Yeah, there's a heightening of senses that I think is really wonderful about that sort of thing. And obviously, unfortunately, it's inevitable that heightening will pass, but there's something very exciting about being provoked in that way.
That's what great art does. Yeah. It's like you see your world differently than you did before. You're a different person coming out than you were going in, even if just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going back to our discussion of the order we saw things. I was thinking today, both before and after we saw the new version of Cone, what do you think it would have been like if we had seen the digital video version first and then saw the film version second?
In some ways, I think I got a little bit of that effect because I saw You and I Horizontal first, which is video, and then saw Line Describing a Cone on film. And so the difference was really stark that... there's all this incidental light, secondary light, as you called it, from the black portion of the... So that contrast was really clear to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can even guess how it might have been if I had seen the cones in opposite order. Do you have a guess?
Well, I don't know if I have a guess, but maybe this is more about me than the experience. But watching tonight's digital video version, I was in a mood to compare. And so there was a fairly consistent attitude of, how is this different? How is this similar? Whereas I don't think I felt that way quite as much when I was watching the film version last night. Mm. There it was a bit more experiential, a bit less analytical. And I think for me, at least, if the order had been switched, I would have had the more experiential version with the digital video first version, and then with the film version being second, I would have been comparing that one. Mm. And I think that's it's a somewhat different way of looking, not completely different, but somewhat, at least for me, it is.
Now, when you saw it originally in Toronto, I know it was part of the Wavelengths program there, and one of their strengths at that festival and that program is that they have this uncanny ability to pair group films together that were not made together at all, but somehow have some synergy when put together. Yeah. Was there anything shown with this?
There was another tremendous work. I should look up the title because I've forgotten it, but it was a film from Iceland, and it was a landscape film, and it was just a series of shots, quite long takes, where the camera is placed like on a hill or a mountain looking across a valley. And it's time-lapse photography, and so it's light, but often it's light filtered through clouds or the shadows that clouds create on far mountains or far valleys. And it's just strikingly beautiful. I mean, profoundly beautiful, this play of light. Because again, it's taking something that would otherwise be very familiar, you wouldn't really notice twice. And yet, because you are looking at it, and because it's been constructed in a particularly beautiful way, or at least a way that forces you to think about it, so we saw that first. We saw the McCall last, if I remember right. And so you kind of are already thinking about light. And then you go into this much less realistic's not the word. What am I looking for? I mean, the McCall, the line describing a cone, is so rigorous and so non-representational. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. You know, it's just light. Mm-hmm. And yet the pairing of those two is really fantastic because you were already sort of prepared in thinking about this idea or these themes.
Yeah.
Can you think of other things you've seen that feel that you find kinship with this one, or that you think would make an interesting pairing if you were gonna program a night of light works?
Gosh, I don't know. There's the name of that program in the festival comes from a Michael Snow film, Wavelengths, which is a long, slow zoom across a room.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is so perfect. Yeah. And I actually did think of that tonight, because in some ways they are, they're of the same shape. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this, something about the way lenses work. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're moving forward, you're moving through a cone in some ways.
Yes, that's true.
And so I thought of that, but also I thought about just sort of the perfect idea of this. You almost don't have to make it. It's such a good idea. Mm. You know, you can just describe, what if there were just a long, slow zoom across a room? Or what if there were other things about that film going on, but the primary thing is simply that, he's moving very slowly across a room. And this in some ways had that same purity, you know, that it's just, we all know where this is going. We can see that it's drawing a circle. It's just perfect. You know, it's perfectly simple. And I sort of liked that in contrast to You and I Horizontal, which has a much more, has lots of nooks and crannies and corners and edges.
Yep.
And you can sort of wait for them to change, and there's much more variety.
Yep.
But there's also something to be said for the simple purity of a circle and a cone and a smooth shape.
Yeah, it is. And there's a real rigor about it, which is kind of bracing. And beautiful, because it is a profoundly beautiful thing to watch it, and you don't usually get sort of things that are that rigorous and also that beautiful. It's a very strange combination. McCall mentioned today that one of the inspirations for his work was actually Warhol's Empire, which is I think it's like an 8-hour shot of the Empire State Building, and I actually. He sort of mentioned this in passing. I think he had talked about it earlier in the talk that I missed. But he was talking about it in the context of duration. And I hadn't sort of thought of that in the context of line describing a cone. But that sense that we with in Cone, you go into it knowing it's about 30 minutes. But even if you don't, you can get a pretty good sense of how long it's going to take for this circle to go.
Yeah.
But it would be very different if you didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, if you weren't sure how long you were going to be there, which, you know, is sort of somewhat the experience you have in, when you watch some of Warhol's really long, long works.
Yeah, lots of avant-garde film is that way, where it's really testing the idea of how long something should be. Mm-hmm. If it's really short or if it's really long, it's sort of saying something and letting you figure that out
Right. Is
part of the game. You know, it's like R.R. Railroad,
the James Binning.
James Binning's film about trains passing. It's just one train after another passing slowly across the screen, and it ends up being 2 hours long, and so you're sitting there for 2 hours watching trains pass. It's a great film, but it tested your sort of endurance in a way that I don't feel like this does. I think because you know, like you said, you have this, you can see the beginning, the middle, the end, where this is going. So
yeah, Michael Snow has a, by the way, I love Wavelength. It's just an amazing work, but he has another work that is much more difficult, La Région Centrale, which is it's a structural film in the sense that it's a camera that's been placed on a very complicated tripod, and it just sort of moves, and it moves in various ways, but it's been placed in the middle of this fairly desolate landscape, I think on a hill, and it goes on for hours. I think it's like 4 or 5 hours long. I'll have to double check that, but I stayed for, I don't know, an hour, 45 minutes, but because the whole thing of La Région Centrale is that the camera moves in different ways, but sometimes it's like spinning, and it's quite disorienting to watch. And so it's a bit of an endurance test that way too. And it's a little bit more of a difficult experience, I think.
I love it when more mainstream filmmakers or more traditional films incorporate aspects of avant-garde, like of this type, especially like, there are a million examples, but I like, Claire Denis's movie L'Intrus, or The Intruder. There's a scene where she just holds on the water for like a minute and 20 seconds. I timed it at one point. I don't think that's the right time, but at one point I knew the time. But, you know, just making you watch the water for that long, it's like, just stop and think for a minute. You know, right in the middle of a movie, that's I guess maybe not the best example of mainstream film, but that is a movie with characters and story. It's not like a piece of abstract art. So it's, you know, incorporating sort of abstract ideas into that sort of narrative filmmaking, I always find very interesting.
Yeah, it's
and you can find it in, you know, Star Wars or something. You know, any filmmaker can do that.
Yeah, it's one other example. Maybe we've gotten off subject, but when I saw Andy Warhol did a movie called Sleep, which is I think about 6 hours. And again, I didn't stay for all of it. I came in the middle and I left after a couple hours. But it's just it's a series of very long takes of a man who I believe was Warhol's lover. Or sleeping, and you're just watching someone else sleep. But the long takes at a certain point stop, or there's a cut into another take of him sleeping, and so it raises all these questions about editing and where editing and where the cut comes and what comes after the cut and so forth and so on. But one of the things that I enjoyed when I saw that film was I was sort of inspired to move around the theater. Because there were not many people at Andy Warhol asleep. You know, there's one of maybe 8 or 9 people in this 300-seat theater. And so it was very easy to get up and move. And so I watched it from the back of the theater, and then I watched it from the front of the theater. Then I moved to the side, and I kept sort of switching my seat. And it actually quite changed the experience of watching the film. It was I had started doing this to keep myself from falling asleep because I was finding myself getting drowsy. Like, okay, I need to get up and move. But I was surprised at what a different experience it was. And I think that in certain ways, to bring it back to McCall, there's these kinds of avant-garde experimental films. They challenge you to think about the experience of looking in so many different ways that hopefully that inspires my own experience with more traditional forms of cinema, that, you know, there's you can find those moments, you know, like you say, even in Star Wars or, you know, in a variety of movies, that even if they're not intentionally there, you can still experience a different way of looking by seeing a film.
And in the case of these films tonight, just to remind you that at a very fundamental level, there are things that we do and maybe don't understand about what we're seeing.
Yeah.
The very fact that light is moving through the room.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. You know, after we stopped recording, we kept thinking of things that we meant to say. Like, I love that the name of the remake of Line Describing a Cone is Line Describing a Cone 2.0. And I love that there was something about the digital version that inspired people to take more pictures as they were watching this thing. Or there were social aspects and other things that we meant to talk about and couldn't. It's sort of strange that you could talk this long and still have more to say about something so simple.
Because there was this sort of rum or hum of the projector, people felt free to talk, whereas they didn't really feel free.
But what you're hearing is our innovative solution to this problem. Next week we'll be rolling out this new technology, which will allow us to pack more in, more into the same space.
I think another thing about the film version is you mentioned that it's both more and less solid, the digital one. Mm-hmm. It's true. It's like because you can't see between the pixels.
There's a next time, you say? Ha. Maybe so. You may remember last year, I said that we soon would have a discussion about rewatching movies. And we did. You just didn't hear it, but you will. You will. And the other thing I have to say is that I'm changing the sign off to nevertheless. Nah, I'll go back to the old one.